It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show,
attorneys, judges, and guardian ad litems try to do everything they can to not have a child testify in court. Generally, that's because they're trying to look out for the best interest of the child, and generally having a child testify in a formal court setting or in front of the parents about pretty emotionally charged events is not going to be in that child's best interest. However, children may tell their guardian ad litem, and the guardian ad litem would be an attorney appointed to represent the interests of the child. The child may tell the guardian ad litem about acts of abuse that they've witnessed, and then that guardian ad litem can make a recommendation based on what they've heard from the child.
Private attorney Chris Bernhardt explains how domestic violence affects child custody, child visitation, child support, spousal support, property division, and grounds for divorce. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn why the recent drop in the unemployment rate is no cause for celebration. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 226, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Job gains were surprisingly weak in December, with the economy adding only 74,000 jobs, as the nation's long-term unemployment crisis showed no signs of abating. The unemployment rate dipped to 6.7%, but that decline was largely the result of workers dropping out of the labor force. Long-term unemployment remained near record highs, with 3.9 million workers, or nearly 38% of the unemployed, out of work for 6 months or more. To make matters worse, Congress has taken away from a struggling Americans the very program designed to help them get back on their feet. Nearly 1.5 million long-term unemployed workers have already been cut off from federal jobless aid, and an additional 72,000 people are joining their ranks every week because lawmakers allowed the Federal Emergency Unemployment Compensation, or EUC, program to expire at the end of 2013. Unemployment insurance for more than 3 million unemployed workers will be severed by the middle of 2014 if Congress fails to act. According to Christine Owens, director of the National Employment Law Project, any other man-made or natural disaster that inflicted this much damage, walloping an average of 10,000 people per day, would be a state of emergency, and we'd marshal all our resources in response. Instead, Congress ended the year by turning its back on people who want to get back to work but can't find jobs, and now is moving too slowly to restore the crucial unemployment insurance lifeline that millions of Americans urgently need to keep looking for work, pay their bills, and stay warm in the months ahead. Finding work remains challenging for the long-term unemployed. Nearly 4 million Americans have been unemployed for longer than 6 months, an unprecedented level three times greater than when the recession began. The record high levels have persisted for more than 4 years. there are still 3 unemployed workers for every job opening, and the average duration of unemployment exceeds 37 weeks. Federal unemployment insurance keeps workers in the job hunt and families out of poverty. And a clear majority of Americans recognize this effect, backing renewal of federal jobless aid for the long-term unemployed, according to a poll released last month by Hart Research. But obstruction and delay by members of Congress continue to rule the day. Attempts to achieve agreement on what appear to be modest, scaled-back compromise approaches to renew the program have been met with callous indifference. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here in Midlothian at the offices of Busey and Dix. We are speaking with one of the attorneys here, Chris Bernhardt, and we will be talking about domestic violence and its impact on other areas of family law, particularly custody, visitation, support, property division, things of that nature. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you, Marty. Good afternoon.
Nice to be here. And to start off our listeners, would you begin by telling us, in general, what under Virginia law is considered domestic violence?
Actually, in Virginia, there's no definition of domestic violence. However, in general, when I'm talking about domestic violence, what I'm talking about is a pattern of physically, sexually, or emotionally abusive behaviors used by one individual to assert power or maintain control over another in the context of an intimate or family relationship. But within that definition, there are things that Virginia law has to say about behavior that constitutes domestic violence. Of course, there's the criminal code addresses a behavior of domestic violence, and also Virginia has something that it calls family abuse that falls under domestic violence.
And if someone is a victim of family abuse, just tell us briefly what civil protections are available.
The number one protection that's available for family abuse would be the protective order. And protective orders can be applied for at the general district courts or the juvenile domestic relations district court. And those are orders that would prohibit contact between the person who's abused and the abuser.
Now, if the victim and the abuser have no children in common, if they're not married, I would imagine that the protective order would pretty much be the first and last thing that the victim would need. But if they do have children in common, and if they are married, there are other issues that come up. And what I wanted to talk with you about was how the domestic violence or family abuse is going to affect those other issues. So let's start with child custody. How is domestic violence going to affect the court's decision when it comes to child custody?
Well, Marty, domestic violence is going to be a big factor in a court's determination about child custody, or it can have a big influence on how an attorney handles a case involving child custody. First of all, there's a series of factors called the best interest of the child factors that a court by law must consider when determining child custody. And one of those factors is a history of family abuse between the parties. Also, one of the other factors is the tendency of each parent to support the child's relationship with the other parent. Oftentimes, in a domestic violence relationship, one parent, in an effort to exercise control over the other parent, will try to deny that parent's contact with the child. So if one parent refuses to allow the other parent to see the child, that would be something that the court would consider when making that decision about custody. Another thing that is going to be a big factor with custody is whether joint custody or sole custody is going to be appropriate. In many relationships of domestic violence, it's going to be very difficult for parents to cooperate and work together in their child's best interest due to that imbalance of power in the relationship.
Now, one of the assumptions I think that people probably have is that the victim of the family abuse certainly has an advantage in getting child custody as opposed to the abuser. So I guess this is a compound question. First, is that generally true? And secondly, is the custody determination affected at all by whether the child was exposed to or knew about the family abuse or was not exposed to and did not know about the family abuse?
So your first question, Marty, was whether generally someone who's a victim of family abuse has an advantage in a custody determination. And that really is going to depend on the facts of the case. As I mentioned, there's these best interest of the child factors. So really what the court's looking at is what is in the child's best interest. And the domestic violence is going to be one factor out of many, and it's not necessarily going to be determinative. However, in cases where the abusive parent has abused the child or has abused the spouse in front of the child or has denied one parent contact with the child, those are definitely going to be factors that will favor the victim of family abuse. However, your second question is about whether a child who's been exposed to domestic violence, who's actually witnessed an abusive parent abusing the other parent, whether that's going to be a factor. The answer is absolutely. Courts would definitely consider that to be a negative factor, that they do not consider that to be appropriate behavior by a parent. And one of the factors I mentioned before is the tendency of each parent to support the child's relationship with the other. And when one parent is abusing the other parent, that would reflect poorly on that parent's ability to make positive decisions for that child's well-being.
And sometimes, especially if the child is old enough, let's say close to teenage or even teenage years, the victim might want to use the child as a witness in the custody fight. Do you find that judges will allow the child to testify either in front of the parents or possibly in private, just within the judge's office with the lawyers and possibly a guardian ad litem there?
Marty, in general, attorneys, judges, and guardian ad litems try to do everything they can to not have a child testify in court. Generally, that's because they're trying to look out for the best interest of the child, and generally having a child testify in a formal court setting or in front of the parents about pretty emotionally charged events is not going to be in that child's best interest. However, children may tell their guardian ad litem, and the guardian ad litem would be an attorney appointed to represent the interest of the child. The child may tell the guardian ad litem about acts of abuse that they've witnessed, and then that guardian ad litem can make a recommendation based on what they've heard from the child.
So it sounds like that is by far the most preferred way to get the child's story through the guardian ad litem as opposed to in some sort of more formal court setting.
That's right. It would be a rare situation indeed where I think the parties would want to have the child testify in the court.
Okay, let's turn to child visitation. And again, I think there's an assumption that may or may not be valid that if the child custody is given to the victim of the family abuse, that the abuser's visitation with the child should in some manner be limited, restricted, supervised, etc. Do you find that to be the case, or do you find that, in fact, there's no such assumption?
So, Marty, that's a really good question. Many people do think that because they've been a victim of domestic violence, that that means that the other parent should not be able to see the child. And it really depends on that parent's, the abusive parent's relationship with the child and what their history with the child has been. So if there has been no physical abuse, no domestic violence between the abusive parent and the child, there really has to be a good reason to restrict that parent's visitation with that child.
So I've heard it said that you can be a rotten husband and a good father, or you can be a rotten wife and a good mother, And in those situations, I would imagine that the court would impose little, if any, restriction or supervision on visitation by the abusing parent with the child.
I think that in general is correct. When there's no history of bad behavior by the abusive parent in relationship to that child, very unlikely there's going to be restrictions on that visitation. That said, when there is a history of violence between the abusive parent and the other parent, there very well may be limitations placed on how that visitation can take place, such as where the exchange of the child will take place, preferably in a public space, so the victim of the domestic violence is not isolated and able to get help if need be.
Okay, now let's turn to the money issues, the child support, and then later the spousal support. Obviously, the both parents owe a duty of support. Let's assume again that the child custody is given to the victim of the family abuse, and the abuser has to pay child support. Does the fact that there was family abuse directed toward the other parent, the custodial parent, play into the child support determination at all?
Virginia law does not consider a history of family abuse in determining child support amounts and an obligation to pay. So really, domestic violence affects child support in a different way rather than the calculation of the amount of money. For example, while a parent has a duty to support his or her child, sometimes an abusive parent may not wish to pay that support as part of their efforts to control the other parent. So in these cases, it's very important that the court order things such as automatic withholdings of income so the child can be guaranteed to get that income.
And if there is, let's say, the abuser quits the job, so there's no income to withhold from, as a way of basically trying to, again, as you say, exert control over the victim, what should the victim do in that situation?
Fortunately, the law allows income to be imputed to a parent who's no longer working. And this is something that we often see with abusive parents, where they will voluntarily stop working or pretend to stop working so they don't have an obligation to pay child support. However, the victim of the abuse can then go to the court, ask for a modification of the child support order, and put on evidence that the other parent has the ability to work. They're simply choosing not to avoid paying child support, and the court has the authority to what's called imputing income, or say that this person could be making this amount of money if they weren't pretending not to.
Okay, let's talk about spousal support or alimony right now. But how does the domestic violence or the family abuse play into whether the victim is going to be able to get spousal support from the abuser?
In Virginia, spousal support is economic support by one spouse to the other after the parties have separated. And the Virginia law specifically considers the reasons for the breakdown of the marriage in determining an amount of spousal support or whether to award spousal support at all. Unlike child support, which is going to be essentially automatic, spousal support is not automatic, and someone has to prove that they're entitled to it. So a victim of domestic violence can put on evidence of a history of emotional, economic, and physical abuse, and the court consider that in determining whether spousal support would be appropriate to award.
And we call it spousal support because it's only awarded to people who are married to each other. There's no such thing as palimony in Virginia, correct?
That's correct, Marty.
Okay, so the court can consider and should consider the history of family abuse, domestic violence in determining spousal support. How does that play over into property division? Again, we're talking only about married people because only they have the right to what we call equitable distribution, that is, distribute the marital property in a way that seems fair. How does the court do that in a domestic violence, family abuse situation?
That's a good question, Marty. In many cases, when two people who are married choose to separate and get a divorce, they oftentimes are able to come to what's called a property settlement agreement, which would be a voluntary agreement between the two of them to divide fairly all the property that they attained during the course of their marriage. However, these property settlement agreements are only going to work when the party can come to an agreement, and that's simply not often possible when there's a history of domestic violence. And then the court has option of doing what's called equitable distribution, which is the process by which the court decides what is a fair distribution of the marital property. A court is specifically allowed to consider the reason for the breakdown of the marriage, which would include cruelty, this physical abuse, domestic violence, and also economic abuse in determining how to divide the property. An example would be if the abusive spouse had prevented the other spouse from working outside of the home or having any assets in his or her name, the court could take that into account and give that spouse a little bit of additional money when dividing the assets.
And the final question, I guess, is how does all of this domestic violence and family abuse affect the actual grounds for divorce, assuming that one party or the other, particularly the victim of the family abuse, decides, well, I'm going to end this marriage, I'm going to file for a divorce. There are fault divorces, there are no-fault divorces. How does the family abuse fit into all of that?
Well, Marty, cruelty is a ground for divorce in Virginia. And when we talk about cruelty, what we're talking about is an act that causes bodily harm or reasonable fear of bodily harm. It can also be behavior that creates a danger to life, limb, or health. So to the extent that a pattern of angry words, insults, humiliation is really endangering the health and well-being of the other spouse, that could also amount to cruelty. So domestic violence, if it goes on for long enough, and can amount to cruelty, and that would be a grounds for divorce. In Virginia, cruelty as a ground for divorce, you can only get divorced a year after the event that would constitute cruelty. You couldn't file for divorce immediately on the basis of cruelty. However, sometimes domestic violence is so bad that the behavior constitutes a felony under Virginia criminal law. And in those cases, if an abusive spouse's acts result in a conviction for felony, that would enable the victim spouse to file for a divorce immediately on the grounds that the other spouse had been convicted of a felony.
But in the typical situation, if there hasn't been a conviction for a felony and incarceration, it sounds like to get a divorce, a fault-based divorce based on physical cruelty, requires a year's waiting period. And to get an uncontested divorce, a no-fault divorce, also requires that same 1 year waiting period. So is there any advantage to a victim of domestic violence pursuing the fault-based divorce after the year when they could also pursue a no-fault divorce after the year?
Yes. And the reason is, as we discussed earlier, if the person pursuing the fault-based divorce is able to prove that they were the victim of cruelty, family abuse, domestic violence, that's something that the court can then consider in distributing the property, awarding spousal support, and also awarding custody if that's something that the court who's granting the divorce is also considering.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We have been talking with Chris Bernhardt. He is an attorney at the law firm of Busey and Dix out in Midlothian, Virginia, and we have been talking about domestic violence, family abuse, and its impact on other family law issues such as child custody and visitation, child support, spousal support, property division, and divorce. Thank you so much for being on the show, Chris.
Thank you, Marty.
Ain't gonna let this termination turn me around.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. It's tax season, and not knowing the tax laws could cost you hundreds or even thousands of dollars. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when Nancy Porcari from the Community Tax Law Project offers tax tips for the 2013 tax year and for your income tax filing due April 15, 2014. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright. Oh.